phase, the code that was used by Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson was the code for roughly the 4,000 base pair code for the 1,200 amino acid spike protein, which is the lethal part of the virus. Now, Hakim and colleagues have shown that the virus offers at least 15 other proteins out there that the body can respond to with a natural infection, but the vaccine approach was going to be against a single protein, so one out of the 15, so that you knew right away that was going to be a limitation. But it was thought to be the spike protein was most lethal, and that could be neutralized. The clinical trials were done, and they were done over the course of about 2 months with a month of observation. I'll give it 3 months, which is very short. The prior regulatory standard for a vaccine, which were previously antigen, live attenuated, or killed vaccines, was 2 years. 2 years for vaccines that had no genetic or intracellular component to them. And it was shortened to just a couple of months with Operation Warp Speed. Now, importantly, the FDA classifies all of these genetic products as gene transfer technology. That means they should have had 5 years of safety observation to see if they incorporated into DNA, to see if they caused birth defects, cancer, etc. All that was skipped. Said, listen, this is an emergency. This is Operation Warp Speed. The clinical trials came in and they declared over 90% efficacy in reducing the rates of COVID respiratory infection. But when we look at the endpoints, it was largely just whether or not someone got basically the head cold. There were no reductions in hospitalizations and deaths. In fact, hospitalization and death, that was the problem. That wasn't even the declared endpoint of these trials. So if there's not a declared primary endpoint, then it's impossible scientifically to make a claim later on that the vaccines reduce hospitalization and death. By strict hypothesis testing, strict clinical science, strict regulatory law, that any claim on reducing hospitalization and death could only be hypothesis generated, has to be proven in a large randomized trial, of which we had plenty of opportunity. These companies through Operation Warp Speed in the United States had unlimited funding. They could have done large trials in high-risk people that used hospitalization and death as a primary endpoint. They actually chose not to do that. In fact, some of these vaccine programs had chosen very low-risk populations. I remember the Johnson & Johnson program. 60% of patients in Johnson & Johnson had no medical problems. I can tell you, those would be people who I wouldn't even treat for COVID. So you know, they had chosen very low-risk populations. So many errors were made in the clinical trials program, didn't choose high-risk individuals, had very low rates of events. We were stunned when we saw the Pfizer Moderna programs. They had less than 1% of people getting COVID. We said, what's going on? I was treating patients. You know, some of our labs in Texas had 5, 10, 15% lab positivity rates. We were wondering, how are these clinical trials? Even in placebo, there was less than a 1% chance of getting COVID. We said, where are they getting these patients from? They must have been the most careful and fastidious patients of all time. In fact, now we've learned there's a paper published that gathered all the site clinical trial data. And what we learned is that in areas where the prevalence of COVID-19 was higher, the vaccines didn't have nearly the protective rate that that was overall declared. So that 90% plus effectiveness, it turns out that was tenuous. But very importantly, when the rates are less than 1%, that means the absolute risk reduction is negligible. So in a population, even taking the results at face value, we knew, and I testified under oath, the vaccines were not going to have any impact on the population. None. Because when the absolute risk reduction is less than 1%, it's mathematically impossible for them to influence the health of populations. Yet with all these shortcomings, the vaccines rolled out. And, you know, what came about of this was a complete disaster. You know, it was originally offered in the United States as elective. One could do it. It was experimental. The consent form said it was experimental. People started to, you know, wade into this electively. We now know under court-ordered documents that Pfizer, within 90 days, had actually recorded 1,223 deaths with their product, which is stunning for of post-marketing people. They had to hire 600 employees just to man the phone calls of all the vignettes of people dying after taking the vaccine. And as a standard, about 50 deaths for a big program like this, the company would just pull it off the market. Something's gone wrong from the clinical trials. Remember, they had gone from clinical trial grade materials. They had gone to mass production. They had gone to multi-use vials. Remember, it had to be super cool, but now it was being distributed everywhere. We weren't sure if the manufacturing or the handling changed. The multi-use vials was a big deal because it means lots of needles were put into it. It could have been oxidized or hypersulfated. Lots of things changed, but there was no product recall. There was no product recall. And in the whole Pfizer dossier part of this, the lawyers for the FDA did not want to release that document to Americans for 55 years. So we know through this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that was launched by Aaron Seary and co-counsel Elizabeth Brem, we knew that the FDA was actually involved in a cover-up. The FDA was trying to cover up a large number of deaths occurring with Pfizer. And so as the program rolled out, besides reporting to Pfizer, doctors could report to our CDC VAERS system. In fact, the consent form says, you know, make sure you report to VAERS if someone dies or is injured. This vaccine adverse event reporting system, by January 22nd, in the VAERS system, which is grossly underreported, there was 182 deaths. Now, Pfizer was collecting these deaths as they were reporting in. Pfizer had a lot more, but VAERS had 182. Now, the total number of deaths that ever occur ambiently or, you know, stochastically with the entire 70 vaccine schedule in the United States is 150. So we are already too far. And one of the things that we didn't see that was fully expected is that the vaccine program should have had a clinical event committee, a data safety monitor board, a human ethics committee, because it's still a big investigation. None of those. There was no safety report. Nothing. If there was a proper data safety monitoring board, I know because I lead these efforts and I do so for the NIH and Big Pharma, this would have been shut down in February of 2021, February, probably early February, as excess mortality. But yet none of these were happening because in the United States, we had actually positioned the CDC and the FDA to be co-sponsors of our vaccine program. They were told to get a needle in every arm. The CDC is not supposed to be doing that. They're supposed to be providing recommendations and outbreak analysis, and the FDA is supposed to be the safety watchdog and the advertising regulatory body. The FDA is not supposed to be leading a clinical program. So we actually had the two entities in the United States who are supposed to be safeguarding Americans. Instead, they were steamrolling a program that was grossly unsafe and people were dying.
Now, you've mentioned some of the consequences of taking these jabs, and death is one of them. Pfizer, in the first 3 months of their trial, found over 1,200 deaths. Yet, despite all of that, President Biden ordered a federal mandate. And in particular, I want to bring you to airports, because I know you've made an intervention with pilots. I believe in roughly December 2021, is it correct, you wrote to the Federal Aviation Authority, raising concerns about pilots who were subjected to these injection mandates. Because if these are causing deaths, then one can imagine if you're operating heavy machinery, and an airplane by definition is heavy machinery, and if you happen to be, God forbid, one of these statistics that succumbs to this jab while you're flying a plane, that can be incredibly dangerous, not just for you, but everybody who you're responsible for. So is it correct? Did you write raising concerns to the Aviation Authority? And if so, what did they respond to you with?
Now, I was part of a large group that wrote, and now the aviation authorities, but you know, I've been an expert now on probably nearly 100 lawsuits, including, you know, all branches of our U.S. military are being sued. Many municipalities are being sued because deaths occurring, as it turns out, are not entirely predictable. An analysis from Queen's University by McLachlan and colleagues just in April of 2021, where he analyzed the vignettes from VAERS and coded them and graded them, he concluded 86% of the time, there's no other explanation outside the fact the vaccine was taken. Analyses by Rose and others have shown that, you know, 50% of the deaths occur within 48 hours, 80% of deaths occur within a week. So what we found out is the aviation community was not, you know, having them take a week off or 2 days off. They were actually flying during that high risk death period. And indeed, if a pilot died in flight, it could imperil everyone on the plane, as makes common sense. Same thing with a bus driver, a train operator. And so this, you know, this vaccine program, besides the individual risks of death, and, you know, I haven't mentioned all the other things that can happen and the mechanisms for death, could imperil others. And yet there was willful blindness. That's the correct term, that all entities were willfully blind, and that the mantra of safe and effective, which basically became propaganda. It's no different than saying ivermectin and horse paste when the vaccines were saying safe and effective. That's propaganda. And anyone can understand this, because how can we know if they're safe if there's no long-term safety data? So this idea that it's safe, what they should say is we're hoping it's safe, but no one knows because they're brand new. Anything that's brand new, we can't know if it's safe until we have long-term safety data. So everyone should understand this, that safe and effective cannot be, because we haven't had enough time to determine that.
Are you at this stage, because look, I mean, we're aware that some pilots raise this as a concern and were even potentially threatening strikes because of these mandates, similarly in the military. Could it ever be justified, whether it's with these jabs or any other treatment, to impose and mandate upon people that have not only responsibility over their own bodies, but over the bodies of others that they're caring for in their profession? Could it ever be justified, considering the risk of blood clots, myocarditis? It is shocking to me that we crossed that certain threshold of my body, my choice when it comes to medical procedures. In your view, though, is this ever justified?
Well, you mentioned we crossed the line of what's called protection of human subjects. In the United States, we have an Office of the Protection of Human Subjects, OHRP, and they have six cornerstones of bioethics. The first one is considered the Declaration of Helsinki, which is full informed consent. And we can't provide full informed consent because these are brand new. We don't know what's going to happen. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that that we violated the Nuremberg Code. Remember, the Nuremberg comes from the Nuremberg trials of Nazi doctors and Nazi research done on the citizens of Germany. And we know there that the Nuremberg Code says that no one, under any circumstances, may receive any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal for either taking or not taking any medicine or injection. So yes, we've crossed these lines. We've crossed these lines with these mandates. Now, people have said, well, it's an emergency. And the emergency, the better good of the population now takes priority over individual rights of personal autonomy or even shared decision-making with their doctors. But I would say this, that in mid-2021, when our CDC director came out and said, you know what, they don't stop transmission of the virus. You transmit it the same. That when Boris Johnson in the UK came out and said they don't stop, the vaccines don't stop anybody from getting COVID or transmitting it, when public officials uttered these conclusions, which were correct, at that point in time, it didn't matter what, you know, what one could say. There was absolutely no scientific support for ever having a large population be encouraged to take these products, let alone be mandated to do so.
So in your view then, because what I'm hearing you say is something I've said from a historic and political and civil liberties perspective, I've clearly made a case that this would be a war crime. If you medically experiment on a population through mandates, and I focus on the mandates because that's where the coercion comes in, clearly even voluntarily, one shouldn't be deceived and one should be not just consent, but have informed consent. But mandates takes all of that away, whether it's informed or not. Now, in the case of mandates, I've stated the view that based on the Nuremberg precedent, based on the Universal Declaration of Bioethics, that to mandate a medical procedure on a population, regardless of whether or not it works, would constitute in this context a war crime. In your medical and professional view, is there any substance to that charge? And if so, where do we go from here, Peter?
Yes, there is substance to that charge, and I completely agree. Do you know, if I was doing a research project, let's say in diabetes, and I told my patients, you have to be in this research project. Otherwise, there's consequences. You're going to lose your job. You're going to get kicked out of my clinic. Do you know, I would actually almost certainly be reprimanded and have severe professional damages occur to me for violating medical ethics. I could never, you know, for a research product, I could only say, listen, there's risks and benefits of participating in research. It's up to you. And that, and that's how it was originally rolled out. It was all thought, listen, you could try. There was a big wave of people taking the vaccines. But when people started dying, the rate of vaccination in the United States plummeted after April of 2021. The word got out. People talked to one another. Didn't you have to, the censorship couldn't stop this. The rates of people dying were extraordinary. And then no one wanted to take the vaccine. And then remember the inducements, you know, have a beer, have an ice cream, have a hot dog. How about $1 million raffle? How about, you know, payment for employment? How about, a free college scholarship? How about a trip to a brothel in the EU? Majid, these are considered coercive. They are illegal in research. So these are examples of illegal activities going on. They're illegal in terms of regulatory law. That they cannot be done. I cannot offer somebody a free college scholarship if they want for them to be in my research study. I can't do it. I can't offer them a $500 voucher. So, you know, we have laws. So when we started to see laws being violated, we started seeing crude propaganda, safe and effective, horse paste. There's many examples of this. And then we saw large numbers of people die. John Leake, who's my co-author, John is who's a criminal investigator. He's, you know, he's a forensic expert. John has concluded the two major crimes have gone on. One is fraud, that the population has been defrauded by propaganda. And that two, that there's mass negligent homicide. And the level of evidence we have now is clearly more probable than not, 51%.
And when you say mass, though,
yeah,
are the figures on that in your estimation?
Yeah, well, I would say that we're probably at clear and convincing, over 80% probability. And what are the numbers? Well, we can go to the June 11th, 2022. Notice how I'm citing the source documents. When was the last time you saw a MHRA official cite the documents with the degree of precision I'm doing? When was the last time you've seen anybody come close to that? How about anybody in academia trying to support the vaccines? No one has the precision that I have. June 11th, 2022, the World Council for Health issues a pharmacovigilance report. And they cite 39 worldwide safety systems, and they focus on four major ones: the CDC VAERS system, the UK Yellow Card, the EU EUDRA, and the WHO VigiSafe. Over 40,000 deaths confirmed, and that's thought to be a gross underreporting worldwide. Many millions of injuries, disabilities as a result of the vaccine. I told you, 50 per product, and they showed examples where, you know, just a handful of cases after a vaccine of some damaging result would be taken off the market. This is how far this has gone. In the United States, a paper by Pantazaktos and Seligman from Columbia estimate upper bound of the confidence interval for deaths after vaccination through December of 2021. This is on the ResearchGate server. 187,000 Americans may have died due to the vaccine. Remember, in Vietnam, we only lost 58,000. This is worse than a war.
Now, I'm hearing these figures and I'm thinking, this sounds worse than thalidomide. It sounds worse than other examples of pharmaceutical malpractice, whether it's the Tuskegee. And this sounds like medical experimentation on the human population on mass scale, leading to mass deaths. Would anything in your view, and I've been following some of the testimonies in the Senate that you've referred to, both Texas Senate, but also on a wider basis, and in particular some of the senators you've referenced, Rand Paul and others, and their interventions, would any of this, in your view, capture the imagination and the attention of the public and of the politicians that have an ability to intervene here with good intention without any form of a Nuremberg-style public investigation or trial against the culprits? Do we need an intervention on that scale that is so impactful that it captures people's imaginations? And what I'm getting at, sir, is that I believe that unless this is taught in history as a lesson of what never to do again, it might happen again in our grandchildren's generation. The only reason we're not, you know, that we are wary of putting people in concentration camps is because we study what happened to the Japanese in America. We study what happened to the Jewish population in Europe. And we study that in schools. And we learn the dangers of using emergencies to try and crack down on individual minority groups. Now, medical procedures, on the other hand, there was a Trojan horse, of course. Everyone's concerned about their health. And it was easy to get under our skin in that sense. In your view, is there, with short of that level of intervention that is then taught in schools for future generations to avoid, are we in danger of repeating this? I mean, what do you think we need to make sure the lessons are learned here?
We are worse than that. We actually are repeating all of the horrific mistakes and crimes that happened in Nazi Germany, but worse, because it's on a worldwide scale and it's being implemented worldwide. By governments, by health systems, doctors, hospitals, large corporations, what we call the biopharmaceutical complex. So this is far worse than Nazi Germany. Yes, we do, and we will have Nuremberg-style types of trials, no doubt about it. But it will be like Nuremberg. It'll be far after the fact. Far after the fact.
You say we will have. You're confident.
Yeah, we will. But it's going to be probably decades in the future. And why is it going to be so late? And the reason why it's going to be late is the same reason why it was late in Germany after the fact, is because right now so many people in the world have actually taken these injections. So they are in what's called mass formation or mass formation psychosis, a topic I'm sure you've covered on your show. This is very important. When the world is in mass formation, they're not ready for Nuremberg trials. There won't be any court, any fairness in a court. There's not going to be any governmental judgment that snaps people out of it. People actually have to come out of formation, because all the individuals that could provide a court decision or that could, fairly adjudicate, all those bodies, they're actually in formation themselves.
I mean, this is quite alarming, Dr. McCullough, because the sentence that this is worse than the crimes committed by Nazi Germany, and it's global, and clearly I take the view it is global, and therefore its reach and impact is on a scale is a lot worse than what happened just in Nazi Germany and its conquered territories. But it's depressing to think that it will take. We're having the conversation of this impact right now here in 2022, and it's worrying to think it may take another, as you say, estimated 10 years or so for people to wake up to the level of crime committed here. It almost feels like the larger the crime, the greater the disbelief that it could happen.
It's true. I think that's a good analysis. And it's because this mass formation is so strong. It's a psychological phenomenon that, you know, there's clear evidence of this is going on. Much credit is given to Matthias Desmet of the University of Ghent in Belgium, young clinical psychologist professor there. In his book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, just out, he lays this out and shows the parallels to Nazi Germany. He gives a lot of credit to Hannah Arendt, who wrote about this actually post Nazi Germany as well. It's always, you know, written after the fact. Desmet, because of his alacrity, is right on it right now. But mass formation says that, you know, there's four elements to this, that we've had a period of isolation and withdrawal. Number two, we've had things taken away from us that we used to enjoy, key relationships. Number three, that we have constant free-floating anxiety. It's just no matter what, there's a new variant or now there's a new threat from monkeypox or Marburg virus. There's always a series of destabilizing events from worldwide, from Me Too to Black Lives Matter to Roe versus Wade to the invasion of Ukraine. We have lots of things that are destabilizing our thought pattern right now, constant free floating anxiety. And the number four is that there's a solution. And the solution comes down from entities of authority. And the solution basically is the method by which the fear is relieved. So when a population is under this incredible, intense pressure of fear, remember the fear is suffering, hospitalization, and death. That's the fear. Remember I told you the suppression of early treatment was to create this fear of suffering, hospitalization, that people through government action believe there is no other solution to this problem outside of to take a vaccine. And the vaccine has started out that this is a one-time shot. You're going to get it. You're going to be fine. 90% effective. Everybody should take it. And then the goalposts started changing. You know, we use this term in football, the goalposts, where we try to kick the ball through, start changing. And we learned, well, they don't last a full year. It's every 6 months. 22 studies showed that quickly the vaccines didn't work after 6 months. And then we learned, well, they really don't work in stopping transmission. And so you can get it anyway. Our CDC director, Boris Johnson, many have said that. And then they said, well, they don't really stop getting COVID. And then, you know, as a final consolation, without any support from randomized trials that used it as a primary endpoint, in my view, no valid observational study supported either, is this claim that, well, the final consolation, even though they don't work, they don't last, is that, well, they reduce your chances of, again, the fear, which would be hospitalized or dying. So that's where we are with the vaccines. They've caused great harm. They're not sufficiently safe. They're not sufficiently effective, in my view, to support it. One of the best decisions I ever took, one of these vaccines. And why didn't I take it? I'm young. I'm strong. I already had COVID before the vaccines came along. So remember, the vaccines are only indicated to prevent COVID if somebody hasn't had it. And so I already had it. And so we have now about a third of the people in the world have made the wise decision not to take the vaccine, or they haven't been approached. They live in areas where there just hasn't been vaccination. In the United States, we only have 18% of Americans who are wise enough to decline the vaccine.
Last question for you, and thank you again for the time. You've been testifying in the Texas State Senate. That's why I initially said to you, hey, we should talk, because I watched some of your testimony. Now, whether it's the testimony of yourself on a state level, or it's some of the federal level inquiries that are going on in the federal level Senate, where do you think politically some of these testimonies are headed? Do you think that they will gain momentum? Do you think that they have a chance of capturing people's attention? Or do you think that pretty much like your career, there will be further attempts to suffocate these as we get closer to the midterm elections coming up?
Well, you know, the more attempts there are for censorship, the greater the viewership. Remember when I went on Joe Rogan, I brought slides. I gave the producers the slides. I was meticulous. I cited all the data. And then there was this backlash we heard from, Neil Young and Prince Harry and all these individuals that they were going to boycott Spotify. It went to President Biden and Jen Psaki. And I said, listen, I'm happy to review the data with anybody. I'm just citing it. And because of the intense censorship and reaction, it got even more views and more downloads. So every time there's an attempt at censorship, it becomes even more widely. So censorship is absolutely backfired. It's kind of like that Star Wars scene where Darth Vader is getting ready to strike down Obi-Wan Kenobi. And he says, you know, strike me down and I'm going to come back far more powerful than you can ever imagine. That's exactly what's happening to censorship. Look, what you use the example of Dr. White, you know, attempts to censor him. He's come back far more powerful and a far more powerful voice for treating doctors in the UK. People have to understand that censorship, crude propaganda, all of these measures, they always fail in the end. So you're right. I've testified U.S. Senate twice, and I co-moderated the five-hour panel session with Senator Ron Johnson on January 24th, 2022. And we had invitation seats for all the public health officials, everyone there. None of them had the courage to face me or dozens of experts in my field. It was really, really important. It's the reason why my book title is so important, Courage to Face COVID-19. They didn't have the courage for the discussion. I've testified twice in the U.S. Senate. I've testified in the Texas Senate twice, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, in a variety of other houses of representation in the United States. I'm going to be in Virginia tomorrow. And this is by invitation. You know, I'm not out pressing my case. By invitation, people want my opinion for a reason, because the analysis is precise. It's fair balanced. I'm not against vaccines. If these vaccines were safe and effective and they had an application in high risk nursing home patients or workers, I'd be all for it. But this idea that vaccines down to children 6 months old, that should tell people that something is off the rails. You know, 6 month old children never came into the discussion on COVID-19. Never, never, in terms of hospitalization and death, communicability, never. People should understand it's off the rails when that population now is a target population for a genetic gene transfer technology platform. Something's gone wrong, and we need many more people who, you know, have the background and the courage and the integrity to go all the way and render opinions. And I volunteered through the White House press secretary to come to Washington, meet with the president. I'll go over all the data. We've got 1,000 peer-reviewed papers now on vaccine injuries and deaths, 1,000. I'll go over them organized into sections. We can have our surgeon general come, our COVID coordinators come, and let's go over all the data on vaccine safety. Remember, it's safety first. It doesn't matter how good these products are. It's actually safety first. If they're not safe, they shouldn't be used.
Now, you and I have something in common. As you were referencing the attempted censorship against you on the after your recorded episode with Joe Rogan, I was scheduled to be next, and you may have caught what happened. They delayed mine for 3 weeks while that erupted, and everybody intervened, from Joni Mitchell to Neil Young and Jen Psaki at the White House, the former press secretary. And it was an incredibly strange moment, because the Spotify CEO comes out and says, you know, we're going to course correct. We're going to encourage more ethnic minority voices so that we're not accused of being far right. And mine was the very next episode, and yet they censored it for 3 weeks in a direct violation of the very policy he said he wanted to encourage. In the end, it had to come out. And just as you said, because it was delayed for so long, you know, the rest is history. It pretty much crashed the site for a while as well. So thank you very much, Dr. Peter McCullough, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and we hope to speak to you again as and when this situation with your interventions in the COVID debate develops. And if there are any major issues along there, we would love to have you back. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Very difficult to argue with what we have just heard, and in particular because of who was saying it. Now, towards the end of that conversation, as you heard yourselves, allegations of very serious crimes were raised. Now, those crimes, I'd say, don't meet the threshold of absolute 100% proof that requires criminal conviction, but it is, in my view, too close, dangerously close to that level of a threshold for conviction. The evidence there is abundant, and the level of crime we're speaking about, which is probably why I'm being a bit strict on the threshold required to say these people are definitely war criminals, certainly it requires an investigation, because the level of crime that we're speaking about here, again, as you just heard, is something that would far surpass anything we've seen historically in terms of crimes against humanity. Now, all of you who've watched this, there remains one thing to do. How would you feel if shortly after World War II, you learned of similar crimes, whether it be the medical experimentation on minority communities by the Nazis or arbitrary internment? If you learned of similar crimes and were painfully aware that the public was yet to appreciate the sheer level of criminal activity that was engaged in, what would you want to do? How would you react? And I'd say to you, and I'd urge you, that likewise in this situation, after everything we've just heard and the evidence presented, not only in that conversation with Dr. Peter McCullough, I remind you, the most published physician in his field in history, But not only from this conversation, but all the other conversations we've had on The Radical Show, it becomes our duty, it becomes our responsibility, just as it would have been if we were the ones that uncovered what happened after World War II, to warn other people about what's happened, so that at least those within our circle of influence and those that we are concerned about don't subject themselves once again to any future measures that Big Pharma may seek to impose on us, at least until justice is served. So the one thing we can do is spread everything we learn through these conversations to our loved ones. Until next time, thank you for joining us. This is Majid Nawaz here for Radical.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You are listening to Radical, a show on Odyssey.com, video website, O-D-Y-S-E-E. That is hosted by Majid Nawaz. He was speaking to Peter McCullough, recorded July 24th, 2022. Extraordinarily important information. Now, you might consider that this is strange and far-out information to be thinking this way. But you might consider that you might have been conned. It's beyond your control. You have been just watching what is on news and other media sources. But if you don't watch any of those things, you won't be conned. And you can see a direct influence through media into brains of people using a systematic approach of propaganda and psychological manipulation. You must be outside of the effect in order to be able to even think about being able to see it in some way. I mean, I can't fully grasp it, but it's clear that there's a mechanism at work intentionally creating cognitive dissonance amongst people that are not prepared to step outside the viewpoint of that. Now, what can you do to avoid it? The first thing, turn off television, stop watching cable news, stop watching network local news. I mean, these people are putting in their own viewpoints into individual news stories. That's definitely not news. It's
the masses have never thirsted after truth. They turn aside from evidence that is not to their taste, preferring to deify error if error seduce them. Whoever can supply them with illusions is easily their master. Whoever attempts to destroy their illusions is always their victim. According to the psychologist Carl Jung, the greatest threat to civilization lies not with the forces of nature, nor with any physical disease, but with our inability to deal with the forces of our own psyche. We are our own worst enemies, or as the Latin proverb puts it, man is a wolf to man. In Civilization in Transition, Jung states that this proverb is a sad yet eternal truism, and our wolf-like tendencies come most prominently into play at those times of history when mental illness becomes the norm rather than the exception in a society, a situation which Jung termed a psychic epidemic. Indeed, it is becoming ever more obvious, he writes, that it is not famine, not earthquakes, not microbes, not cancer, but man himself, who is man's greatest danger to man, for the simple reason that there is no adequate protection against psychic epidemics, which are infinitely more devastating than the worst of natural catastrophes. In this video, we are going to explore the most dangerous of all psychic epidemics, the mass psychosis. A mass psychosis is an epidemic of madness, and it occurs when a large portion of a society loses touch with reality and descends into delusions. Such a phenomenon is not a thing of fiction. Two examples of mass psychoses are the American and European witch hunts of the 16th and 17th centuries, and the rise of totalitarianism in the 20th century. During the witch hunts, thousands of individuals, mostly women, were killed, not for any crimes they committed, but because they became the scapegoats of societies gone mad. In some Swiss villages, writes Francis Hill, there were scarcely any women left alive after the frenzy had finally burned itself out. When a mass psychosis occurs, the results are devastating. Jung studied this phenomenon and wrote that the individuals who make up the infected society become morally and spiritually inferior. They sink unconsciously to an inferior intellectual level. They become more unreasonable, irresponsible, emotional, erratic, and unreliable. And worst of all, crimes the individual alone could never stand are freely committed by the group smitten by madness. What makes matters worse is that those suffering from a mass psychosis are unaware of what is occurring. For just as an individual gone mad cannot step out of his mind to observe the errors in his ways, so too there is no Archimedean point from which those living through a mass psychosis can observe their collective madness. But what causes a mass psychosis? To answer this question, we must first explore what drives an individual mad. While there are many potential triggers of madness, such as an excessive use of drugs or alcohol, brain injuries, and other illnesses, these physical causes will not concern us here. Our concern is with psychological, or what are called psychogenic triggers, as these are the most common culprits of the mass psychosis. The most prevalent psychogenic cause of a psychosis is a flood of negative emotions, such as fear or anxiety, that drives an individual into a state of panic. When in a state of panic, an individual will naturally seek relief, as it is too mentally and physically draining to subsist in this hyper-emotional state. While escaping from the state of panic can be accomplished through adaptive means, such as facing up to and defeating the fear-generating threat, another way to escape is to undergo a psychotic break. A psychotic break is not a descent into a state of greater disorder, as many believe, but a reordering of one's experiential world, which blends fact and fiction, or delusions and reality, in a way that helps end the feelings of panic. Silvano Arrieti, one of the 20th century's foremost authorities on schizophrenia, explains the psychogenic steps that lead to madness. Firstly, there is the phase of panic, when the patient starts to perceive things in a different way, is frightened on account of it, appears confused, and does not know how to explain the strange things that are happening. The next step is what Arrieti calls a phase of psychotic insight, whereby an individual succeeds in putting things together by devising a pathological way of seeing reality which allows him to explain his abnormal experiences. The phenomenon is called insight because the patient finally sees meaning and relations in his experiences. But the insight is psychotic because it is based on delusions, not on adaptive and life-promoting ways of relating to whatever threats precipitated the panic. The delusions, in other words, allow the panic-stricken individual to escape from the flood of negative emotions, but at the cost of losing touch with reality, and for this reason, Arrieti says that a psychotic break can be viewed as an abnormal way of dealing with an extreme state of anxiety. If a panic-triggering flood of negative emotions in a weak and vulnerable individual can trigger a psychotic break, then a mass psychosis can result when a population of weak and vulnerable individuals is driven into a state of panic by threats real, imagined, or fabricated. But as delusions can take many forms, and as madness can manifest in countless ways, the specific manner in which a mass psychosis unfolds will differ based on the historical and cultural context of the infected society. But in the modern era, it is the mass psychosis of totalitarianism that appears to be the greatest threat. Totalitarianism, writes Arthur Verslewis, is the modern phenomenon of total centralized state power, coupled with the obliteration of individual human rights. In the totalized state, there are those in power, and there are the objectified masses, the victims. In a totalitarian society, the population is divided into two groups, the rulers and the ruled, and both groups undergo a pathological transformation. The rulers are elevated to an almost godlike status, which is diametrically opposed to our nature as imperfect beings who are easily corrupted by power. The masses, on the other hand, are transformed into the dependent subjects of these pathological rulers and take on a psychologically regressed and childlike status. Hannah Arendt, one of the 20th century's preeminent scholars of this form of rule, called totalitarianism an attempted transformation of human nature itself. But this attempted transformation only turns sound minds into sick minds, For as the Dutch medical doctor who studied the mental effects of living under totalitarianism wrote, "There is in fact much that is comparable between the strange reactions of the citizens of totalitarianism and their culture as a whole, on the one hand, and the reactions of the sick schizophrenic on the other. The social transformation that unfolds under totalitarianism is built upon and sustained by delusions. For only deluded men and women regress to the childlike status of obedient and submissive subjects and hand over complete control of their lives to politicians and bureaucrats. Only a deluded ruling class will believe that they possess the knowledge, wisdom, and acumen to completely control society in a top-down manner. And only when under the spell of delusions would anyone believe that a society composed of power-hungry rulers, on the one hand, and a psychologically regressed population, on the other, will lead to anything other than mass suffering and social ruin. But what triggers the psychosis of totalitarianism? As was explored in the previous video of this series, the mass psychosis of totalitarianism begins in a society's ruling class. The individuals that make up this class, be it politicians, bureaucrats, or crony capitalists, are very prone to delusions that augment their power, and no delusion is more attractive to the power-hungry than the delusion that they can and should control and dominate a society. When a ruling elite becomes possessed by a political ideology of this sort, be it communism, fascism, or technocracy, the next step is to induce a population into accepting their rule by infecting them with the mass psychosis of totalitarianism. This psychosis has been induced many times throughout history, and as Mirlu explains, it is simply a question of reorganizing and manipulating collective feelings in the proper way. The general method by which the members of a ruling elite can accomplish this end is called menticide, with the etymology of this word being a killing of the mind, and as Mirlu further explains, menticide is an old crime against the human mind and spirit, but systematized anew. It is an organized system of psychological intervention and judicial perversion through which a ruling class can imprint their own opportunistic thoughts upon the minds of those they plan to use and destroy. Priming a population for the crime of menticide begins with the sowing of fear. When an individual is flooded with negative emotions, such as fear or anxiety, he or she is very susceptible to a descent into the delusions of madness. Threats, real, imagined, or fabricated, can be used to sow fear, but a particularly effective technique is to use waves of terror. Under this technique, the sowing of fear is staggered with periods of calm, but each of these periods of calm is followed by the manufacturing of an even more intense spell of fear, and on, the process goes. Or as Mirlu writes, each wave of terrorizing creates its effects more easily after a breathing spell than the one that preceded it, because people are still disturbed by their previous experience. Morality becomes lower and lower, and the psychological effects of each new propaganda campaign become stronger. It reaches a public already softened up. While fear primes a population for menticide, the use of propaganda to spread misinformation and to promote confusion with respect to the source of the threats and the nature of the crisis helps to break down the minds of the masses. Government officials and their lackeys in the media can use contradictory reports, nonsensical information, and even blatant lies, as the more they confuse, the less capable will a population be to cope with the crisis and diminish their fear in a rational and adaptive manner. Confusion, in other words, heightens the susceptibility of a descent into the delusions of totalitarianism. Or as Mirlu explains, logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal than logic and reason. While the people are still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarians can assault them with another. Never before in history have such effective means existed to manipulate a society into the psychosis of totalitarianism. Smartphones and social media, television and the internet, all in conjunction with algorithms that quickly censor the flow of unwanted information, allow those in power to easily assault the minds of the masses. What is more, the addictive nature of these technologies means that many people voluntarily subject themselves to the ruling elite's propaganda with a remarkable frequency. Modern technology, explains Mirlu, teaches man to take for granted the world he is looking at. He takes no time to retreat and reflect. Technology lures him on, dropping him into its wheels and movements. No rest, no meditation, no reflection, no conversation. The senses are continually overloaded with stimuli. Man doesn't learn to question his world anymore. The screen offers him answers, ready-made. But there is a further step the would-be totalitarian rulers can take to increase the chance of a totalitarian psychosis. And this is to isolate the victims and to disrupt normal social interactions. When alone and lacking normal interactions with friends, family, and co-workers, an individual becomes far more susceptible to delusions for several reasons. Firstly, they lose contact with the corrective force of the positive example, for not everyone is tricked by the machinations of the ruling elite, and the individuals who see through the propaganda can help free others from the menticidal assault. If, however, isolation is enforced, the power of these positive examples greatly diminishes. But another reason that isolation increases the efficacy of menticide is because, like many other species, human beings are more easily conditioned into new patterns of thought and behavior when isolated. Or as Mirlu explains with regards to the physiologist Ivan Pavlov's work on behavioral conditioning, Pavlov made another significant discovery. The conditioned reflex could be developed most easily in a quiet laboratory with a minimum of disturbing stimuli. Every trainer of animals knows this from his own experience. Isolation and the patient repetition of stimuli are required to tame wild animals. The totalitarians have followed this rule. They know that they can condition their political victims most quickly if they are kept in isolation. Alone, confused, and battered by waves of terror, a population under an attack of menticide descends into a hopeless and vulnerable state. The never-ending stream of propaganda turns minds once capable of rational thought into playhouses of irrational forces. And with chaos swirling around them and within them, the masses crave a return to a more ordered world. The would-be totalitarians can now take the decisive step. They can offer a way out and a return to order in a world that seems to be moving rapidly in the opposite direction. But all this comes at a price. The masses must give up their freedom and cede control of all aspects of life to the ruling elite. They must relinquish their capacity to be self-reliant individuals who are responsible for their own lives and become submissive and obedient subjects. The masses, in other words, must descend into the delusions of the totalitarian psychosis. The totalitarian systems of the 20th century represent a kind of collective psychosis. Whether gradually or suddenly, reason and common human decency are no longer possible in such a system. There is only a pervasive atmosphere of terror and a projection of the enemy, imagined to be in our midst. Thus society turns on itself, urged on by the ruling authorities. But the order of a totalitarian world is a pathological order. By enforcing a strict conformity and requiring a blind obedience from the citizenry, totalitarianism rids the world of the spontaneity that produces many of life's joys and the creativity that drives society forward. The total control of this form of rule, no matter under what name it is branded, be it rule by scientists and doctors, politicians and bureaucrats, or a dictator, breeds stagnation, destruction, and death on a mass scale. And so perhaps the most important question facing the world is how can totalitarianism be prevented? And if a society has been induced into the early stages of this mass psychosis, can the effects be reversed? While one can never be sure of the prognosis of a collective madness, there are steps that can be taken to help effectuate a cure. This task, however, necessitates many different approaches from many different people, For just as the menticidal attack is multi-pronged, so too must be the counterattack. According to Carl Jung, for those of us who wish to help return sanity to an insane world, the first step is to bring order to our own minds and to live in a way that provides inspiration for others to follow. It is not for nothing that our age cries out for the Redeemer personality, for the one who can emancipate himself from the grip of the collective psychosis and save at least his own soul, who lights a beacon of hope for others, proclaiming that here is at least one man who has succeeded in extricating himself from the fatal identity with the group psyche. But assuming one is living in a manner free of the grip of the psychosis, there are further steps that can be taken. Information that counters the propaganda should be spread as far and as wide as possible, for the truth is more powerful than the fiction and falsities peddled by the would-be totalitarian rulers, and so their success is in part contingent on their ability to censor the free flow of information. Another tactic is to use humor and ridicule to delegitimize the ruling elite, or as Mirlu explains, we must learn to treat the demagogue and aspirant dictators in our midst with the weapon of ridicule. The demagogue himself is almost incapable of humor of any sort, and if we treat him with humor, he will begin to collapse. A tactic recommended by Vaclav Havel, a political dissident under Soviet communist rule, who later became president of Czechoslovakia, is the construction of what are called parallel structures. A parallel structure is any form of organization, business, institution, technology, or creative pursuit that exists physically within a totalitarian society, yet morally outside of it. In communist Czechoslovakia, Havel noted that these parallel structures were more effective at combating totalitarianism than political action. Furthermore, when enough parallel structures are created, a second culture, or parallel society, spontaneously forms and functions as an enclave of freedom and sanity within a totalitarian world, or as Havel explains in his book, The Power of the Powerless. What else are parallel structures than an area where a different life can be lived? A life that is in harmony with its own aims, and which in turn structures itself in harmony with those aims. What else are those initial attempts at social self-organization than the efforts of a certain part of society to rid itself of the self-sustaining aspects of totalitarianism, and thus, to extricate itself radically from its involvement in the totalitarian system? But above all else, what is required to prevent a full descent into the madness of totalitarianism is action by as many people as possible. For just as the ruling elite do not sit around passively, but instead take deliberate steps to increase their power, so too an active and concerted effort must be made to move the world back in the direction of freedom. This can be an immense challenge in a world falling prey to the delusions of totalitarianism, but as Thomas Paine noted, tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. For more content like this, visit the YouTube channel Academy of Ideas or the website academyofideas.com.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. My show runs every Friday this summer from 6 to 8 p.m. And I thought we would be live this week in the studio, but next week we return live with real people talking about real things here in Medford. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening.
Papa, why can't we telegraph while riding a horse?
Son, there ain't no one to blame but Jeffro. He was riding old Betsy the Stallion, tip-tapping away at his telegraph, when blam! Ran right into the side of the saloon.
Well, if Jeffro can't do it, neither should you. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.